coming right at you. It's the news, according to me. Yes, this is the 159th episode. Kind of random, isn't it? We're celebrating the 159th episode. Yes. Not the 100th, not the 200th. Not the 150th. Just the 159th. I don't know why. I think it's almost been... It's been almost 5 months, I think, since this thing started. I believe. This is the fifth month, I believe. I'm not positive of that. I'd have to look back and see, because I don't look back and see that stuff. But most importantly, I'm drinking some sweet tea here this afternoon. This show is getting off to a very late start. Not super late. This isn't the late night edition. This is like the evening edition, the prime time edition of the news, according to me. It is 7:11 Eastern Standard Time, April 22nd, 2021, the year that it all happened. We are rapidly descending into a seemingly endless abyss of confusion and chaos in this country. it just doesn't seem to end. Does it? It just seems that it just continues to get more confusing and more something. That kind of sums it up right there, doesn't it? Now this morning's show, if you didn't hear it, it was about pretty much all about the word feckless, because it seems so fitting. Basically, it's irresponsible, ineffective, worthless leadership. We have feckless leadership in this country. And I'm not just talking about the current person who resides in the White House. I'm not even sure he knows he's there. Hey, Jill, I don't know. Who are you anyway? Are you the babysitter? Now, if you don't know that story, you need to look into that a little bit. I would say that Joe Biden was probably not a whole lot different than his son. You've heard the term "apple doesn't fall far." I'm sure you've heard that term. Fall. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And the reflection that we have here in little Hunter. And little baby Hunter Biden, sweet little innocent Hunter Biden. The symptoms, the problems that he have are typically symptoms of a deeper issue. And I won't get into that, but it's you can do that research on your own. I trust you. But you'll find something that's very disheartening. Rather alarming about his possible upbringing. Now, keep in mind, I'm going to check this out because I keep hearing this. I've heard this many times, and I'm not sure if it, of course, this is a stupid Google thing. Where's DuckDuckGo at? DuckDuckGo. Duck. How do you spell duck? Go. Let's see what happens if I go here. Unable to find. No, I don't know what it's going to say. Here we go. All right, let's search the web here. Jill Biden was Joe's babysitter. Was Dr. Jill Biden Joe Biden's babysitter? And the answer is First Lady Jill Biden was a teenager working as the Biden family babysitter when she started dating President Joe Biden. Okay, there's a couple different things here. Nelia, and their 13-month-old daughter, Naomi, died on December 7th in a car crash. Also, there was a... Well, some people say she wasn't. Yeah, he has this story about, oh, there's pictures of them. Oh my. Yeah. Yeah, this is pretty obvious. Yeah, whatever you're hearing about this. People are claiming this is false. A lot of people are claiming it's false, that she was not their babysitter. There's pictures here of her as a young person. Yeah. Okay. The story, the narrative that they're giving you is not, he's lying through his teeth, because there's actual pictures of him with the babysitter. She's right there. That's Jill. Yeah. I don't understand how they get away with this crap, how the media continues to cover for this. Yeah. She's there with the kids. Yeah. It's obvious. In fact, this story is almost as weird as Hunter's story with his brother's wife. This is just, oh my gosh, stuff. Yeah, it's all right. You know, that took a turn I wasn't looking for, and I didn't want to go there. But this is pretty sad. It's actually pretty sick. Yeah, and they're lying through their teeth. I'm sure they're trying to scrub the internet of these pictures. Yeah, it's pretty obvious. And holy cow, she was young when they got married. Yeah, he's like 13 years older than her or something ridiculous. Yeah. So that's the feckless leader we have right now in the in the White House. And let me just go over this again, just so you're not lost, because the meaning of the word feckless, very clear. Boy, they have pictures of them just lacking initiative or strength of character, irresponsible. yeah, that's. I would say that pretty much describes 90% of the politicians we have in this country. And then there's, you know, doesn't just stop with the politicians. I'm going to throw that in there to a lot of church leaders as well. Especially the word irresponsible. And even those that I would consider being, you know, spirit-filled, spirit-led individuals. There's some of those that are rather ineffective and irresponsible as well. I'm not saying I could do any better in their position. I'm just saying. I'm just a guy with a microphone with a free podcast that goes out to how many different countries? I don't know. Let's count the number of countries. Because there must be some. Let's see, we got 20 countries. 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29. That's all. 29 countries. That's my bad imitation of Count Dracula. The 29 countries. That's all I got. That's all I got going for me there. Yeah, Venezuela. Look, there's Chile. Chile. Peru. Venezuela. What's that? Costa Rica. Tanzania. Nigeria. Vietnam. Yeah, interesting. So we have this leadership problem in our country right now. I believe it's a leadership issue. And it's an issue of individuals who are really not stepping up. Sorry, I had to cough there for a second. They're not speaking the truth. And the truth is, it's not easy to swallow. People want to elevate themselves. There's this video a guy has of, it's really interesting. This guy is yelling. He's wearing like swim goggles or something. I don't know what he's doing exactly. Doesn't have a shirt on, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, Black Lives Matter. White guy, white pasty man. Out in the middle of the street at night, and there's a group of people there obviously around him, and they're videoing him, and he's screaming this out. And, okay, what does that exactly accomplish? And I guess, you know, this comes back again to the issue, and that's what kind of what I want to talk about tonight, is the issue of protests. Now, you can say, well, it raises awareness. Okay, it raises awareness. And that changes things in what way? Well, some of you would say, well, because Derek Chauvin, whatever how you pronounce his name, would have gotten off the hook, and nobody would have ever known that George Floyd was killed if they hadn't protested and made a big deal out about it. Okay. So, in the process of these protests and looting and rioting, other people died. People who were not criminals. And not white people, not cops. There were some people of color who were killed, who I guess weren't as important, or whose lives were given for the cause of George Floyd, to see to it that George got justice. In the process of all this stuff happening, about $2 billion worth of damage was done. And tell me that didn't affect any the lives of any people of color. People in poor neighborhoods. People who are oppressed. Their neighborhoods were destroyed. The places where they shop for groceries. The places where they shop for goods and things for their family were turned upside down and destroyed. And that made it all worthwhile, because we made people aware. The peaceful protests, I have no problem with those. And I have no problem with raising awareness. I do have a problem with the falsehoods that were raised at the same time around this whole thing. Now, if you don't understand what's going on here, you understand $27 million is paid out. You understand that Black Lives Matter, as far as we know, made over $100 million. We don't know how much really was taken in, because a lot of the donations were not recorded. there are estimates it could have been as much as $250 to $300 million that Black Lives Matter was given. And nobody knows where that money's going. Well, we know where some of it's going, because she's purchased almost $4 million. One of them has purchased almost $4 million in real estate in the last year. So we have this issue of raising awareness, raising money with regard to what is happening, with regard to the cause. And if you heard this what happened with this young lady who had a knife and was shot recently, about right before she stabbed some other girl. Her aunt, I believe it was standing in the street and passionately describing what happened. She wasn't there. She heard it secondhand, from my understanding. She said that there was a knife. She did have a knife, but she had dropped it long before the cops showed up. That the police basically just showed up and shot her. This is what she was telling the crowd of people who were there, and very, very impassioned about it. And by that, I mean colorful language was being used. And describing the scene and describing what happened and how, she was trying to drum up the crowd here. She was trying to make it the whole thing an issue, that the cops did what they did. They murdered her. Here we go again. The cops are murdering our kids. They just keep killing us. And then, of course, the lie, a lie can travel around the world 4 or 5 times before the truth gets its pants on, kind of thing. And this is what happens. And of course, the media picks up on it. Next thing you know, Circleback Psaki is talking about it in a press conference. And they always throw it out there, and then they throw in the old minorities, people of color, are being killed at a much higher rate than white people. Disproportionate rate. And of course, we've talked about that before. Over the span of 12 months, there was, or whatever the span was, 280 killings, or 280 shootings, I should say, by police officers, 280 shootings. And 30 of those were white, or 30 of those were black, I'm sorry, 30 of those were black. Do the math on that. That's actually less than, if you do the proportionate per capita, that's less than the percentage of black people. If you look at the percentage of people, the numbers of people who commit a lot of the crime, almost 47 or 48% of the violent crime that is committed, violent domestic crime in the United States, is committed by about 15% of the population. I should say 15% of the, a segment of 15% of the population. In other words, people of color commit those crimes. Now, I'm not saying it's because the skin color is, and there's anything reason to hate them, because if that means if you're black, you're committing more crime. No, that means there's a cultural issue that has been fostered by people like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and now a whole slew of other people who are now getting in on the race baiting game and convincing black people that they are miserable and oppressed and they can never get anywhere because of their oppression. Now, I hope I can pull this up, because it really needs to be heard. And You know, I was just thinking about this. I was listening to this thing the other day. Maybe I might have to pull it up on my phone, because that's probably the quickest way to get it. Dinesh D'Souza. And I don't know how to pronounce it. There he goes. Here we go. Let's get his channel. He earlier today posted a video, and it was really good. And there it is. Sweet. All right, I'm gonna link this up here to my little mixer. I got all the technology stuff here going on, and so we're gonna hook this booger up, as they say. That's what they say in the industry. That's a term we use it's lingo that we use in the biz here. I'm gonna hook this booger up. That's what we usually say. Hopefully this will play well and everything will be wonderful. But this is the Lieutenant Governor in North Carolina, Mark Robinson, and he talks about some things. And I think what he has to say is absolutely, absolutely pertinent and relevant and spot on, in my opinion. So let's listen to this for a second. It's only a few minutes long. It's about almost 5 minutes long. But we're going to listen to this thing, and I think it's worth repeating. And I just think this guy's got a lot of courage, and he has a lot of fortitude, and he is not, absolutely not, feckless. He is the antithesis, I think that means the opposite, of fecklessness. Absolute hero, in my opinion, for saying what he's saying. But let's listen.
You see, I'm the first black lieutenant governor of North Carolina, and I hail from Greensboro, home of the Woolworth sit-ins, an epicenter of the civil rights movement. I grew up poor as the ninth of 10 children in a home marred by alcoholism. But I had a mother who was a strong woman of faith, and she sustained us. She was also a woman who lived through the terribleness of Jim Crow and witnessed firsthand the sacrifices made by those to ensure that black voices would be heard in government. I know right now she is up in heaven smiling as she sees her son here sitting in this committee hearing. But today I'm not here to talk about myself. I'm here to talk about voter discrimination and election integrity. The subject of this hearing is the evolving landscape of voter discrimination, and it certainly has throughout our nation's history. Let me say that I am very proud of the history in this nation of my people. My people were put in the belly of ships, bound in chains, and endured the Middle Passage. My people were whipped, beaten, and sold as property during slavery. During Reconstruction and throughout Jim Crow, black people were intimidated, harassed, and even killed to keep them from having a voice in government. Symbols like chains, nooses, and burnt crosses are not just symbols of death. They are symbols of forced and coerced silence. The sacrifices of our ancestors, so I could have the opportunity to become the first black lieutenant governor of my state, to see a black man sit in the White House for 2 terms, and for millions of us to be leaders in business, athletics, government, and culture, add up to an incredible story of victory. But today, we hear Georgia law being compared to Jim Crow, that black voices are being silenced, and that black voices are being kept out. How? By bullets? By bombs? By nooses? No, by requiring a free ID to secure the vote. Let me say that again, by requiring a free ID to secure the vote. How absolutely preposterous. Am I to believe that black Americans who have overcome the atrocities of slavery, who were victorious in the civil rights movement, and now sit in the highest levels of this government, cannot figure out how to get a free ID to secure their votes? That they need to be coddled by politicians because they don't think we can figure out how to make our voices heard? Are you kidding me? The notion that black people must be protected from a free ID to secure their votes is not just insane, it is insulting. Just a few days ago, and let me tell you something about this. This doesn't have anything to do with justice. This has everything to do with power. Just a few days ago, the vice president went to the very place that I mentioned, the Woolworth counter in Greensboro. But you know who wasn't there? You know who wasn't invited? My good friend Clarence Henderson, who is a civil rights icon. He sat at that counter and endured the suffering and pain to make sure that black voices were heard. And why was he left out? because he's of a different political persuasion. You might ask why this is so, and I'll tell you plainly. The goal of some individuals in government is not to hear the voices of Black Americans at all. It's to hear the voices that fit their narratives and ultimately help keep power with one group. And that's what this all is all about. It's about power. Just look at H.R. 1. It's despicable. The entire thing is designed to keep one party in power and ensure they stay there indefinitely. And how do they plan to do that? By taking away the rights of states given by the Constitution to govern their own elections, to mandate a wish list, a partisan wish list that comes down from that federal government. Some of these items include using government dollars to fund campaigns in order to give an advantage to one party, mandating that felons are allowed to vote, including illegal immigrants on voter rolls, and of course, trying to ban states from having voter ID. The last thing I'll say is this. Many people know that I'm a strong proponent of the Second Amendment, and I always will be. I believe that the right to keep and bear arms should always be available to law-abiding citizens. But the first line of defense in maintaining the integrity of the Second Amendment is having an ID to show and requiring that ID when you purchase that firearm. In the same way, I believe that voter ID is our first line of defense for protecting the integrity of the right to vote. And that's what this should be about. It should be about integrity, not power. Thank you.
Much, much respect for the man who spoke the truth, the opposite of feckless. Courageous, and I agree with what he said. He's, it is insulting, in my opinion. It's condescending, patronizing, and insulting. When we continue to say that a particular people group can't figure out how to get online, can't figure out how to get an ID. It disenfranchises voters if you have to have an ID. They know exactly why they don't like voter ID. It has nothing to do with disenfranchising voters. They couldn't care less about that. They don't care about voters being killed in Chicago every weekend. The ultimate disenfranchisement. They want to bring people into the country without any restriction, without any knowledge of who they are. Just let the border gates swing wide open. Let them all come in. And let's just make sure we let them vote. As he said, H.R. 1 is an abomination. It's preposterous. It goes against everything for voter integrity. They don't care about voter integrity. And It goes on and on to the point, that's just one issue amongst the pile of things that are happening right now. Everything from gun control to, now, I just saw, there is, I don't care what anybody says, what anybody has told you, there is legislation right now being introduced for mandatory vaccination passports. I've already disconnected my phone from the mixer, but let me see if I can find this real quick, and I will play it. There is a this was sent to me. It's someone actually reading the actual. Here it is, right here. Let's see if I can pull this up and actually play it. Hopefully, you can hear this.
Assembly Bill A416 being proposed for the state of New York. Current status of the bill is in committee. I'm going to skip down to section 412, where it states, in addition to the removal or detention orders referred to above, the governor may in his or her discretion issue and seek enforcement of any other orders that he or she determines are necessary or appropriate, including but not limited to, require an individual who has been exposed to or infected by a contagious disease to complete an appropriate prescribed course of treatment, preventative medication, or vaccination. So this bill would allow them to remove you from your home, force you into quarantine, force medical examination and treatment upon you, including a vaccination. This is no longer a conspiracy theory. If this bill gets passed for the state of New York, that's it. I mean, that's the line.
Okay. Rest of it's her commentary. And we don't care about her commentary because this is the news according to me. This isn't the news according to her. So that there you go. Now, that's the state of New York. Understand, this legislation that's going through New York is legislation that is copied to the House of Representatives. They will do the same thing federally, if they can. And I believe that they will try to do this. Now, they did just pass the resolution, I believe, in the House. Speaking of, this is a side note. the resolution that they had, or the bill that they had for making the D.C. a state. Washington, D.C. Well, Washington, D.C. is not a state, by the way. It is a territory outside of the United States. It basically is Virginia, but it doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of Virginia. It is its own thing. So you have Washington, D.C. there, which, by the way, has one of the highest crime rates in the world, at least in the country. And you get the extreme disparity of between poor and rich people there. Huge, huge number of very wealthy individuals live there. And a rather large number of very poor people living there. Most of the rich people who live there are Democrats, by the way. And it's everybody says the Republicans are the party of money and big business. Yeah. Things like, well, I don't know, like Facebook, Twitter, Amazon. I mean, those kind of big businesses. YouTube, Google, Alphabet, those kind of big businesses you're talking about? The ones who have, very little influence on our lives, on our society. Businesses like CNN, MSNBC. Those are the Republicans, right? Oh, no, wait, those are all Democrat-owned businesses. Most of Silicon Valley is Democrats, leftists. Yeah. But they're for the little guy. No, let me take that back. They're using the little guy. There's a really good statement today made by what's the guy's name? Michael Knowles, about how, you know, the party for the poor, if nobody's poor, then they lose their party. So they try to keep you poor. The reality is they keep you in poverty so they can promise you stuff It was really telling, because what he did was he played a statement that the press secretary gave. You know what her name is? Circleback Psaki. She made this statement about how just when we thought we were going to have hope, it was dashed again by the killing of a 16-year-old girl in Ohio. Had her life taken away from her. Keep the sentence going there, right before she almost took the life of another young lady of color as well. She was stopped from committing murder. At least extremely aggravated. You don't understand. A knife is actually a very effective tool. And more people are killed every year with knives and by strangulation than are killed by guns. In this country. So keep that in mind when you hear the rhetoric and all the crap that they say. And we don't even know how many times a good guy with a gun stops or thwarts a potential violent crime because they don't report that stuff. So she says this, and of course, the point that Michael Knowles was making is that they don't want you to have hope. They don't want you to have optimism. They don't want you to believe it in yourself, to believe that you can somehow attain and overcome and achieve, and that you can work hard and potentially, not promised to you, but potentially. I had a lot of businesses. Before I was married, after I was married, ever since I've been married, and even now. And there's some business principles that you learn just by doing it. I did not go to college to get an MBA. I know people who have. They typically end up working for someone else, which is great. That's not a problem. Good for you. You're productive. You're fitting into society and you're a productive member of society. That's great. But an MBA does not teach you how to be an entrepreneur, how to start something from scratch and go from there and do what you're doing. I guarantee you a degree hanging on the wall is not going to give you the passion and motivation that you need. It's not even going to give you 10% of the motivation that you need to make a business work. Or to even try to make a business work. Because let me tell you, it's frustrating. On every side, there is one obstacle after another. And it's really bad if you're inexperienced and you don't foresee that thing happening. You don't have the foresight to know the potential issues that can hit you. That's why I appreciate young people who are moving out in that venture that they're passionate about. And I love passing on my discouragement. I love passing on my critical thinking skills. Because I'll call it that. That sounds a lot better, doesn't it? And I guess one of the reasons I don't, I'm done trying to do stuff like that. I'd rather invest in somebody else who has the energy and the stupidity. it's the naivete. It's kind of like, when we're younger, we don't realize, we think we're 10 foot tall and bulletproof. Nothing's going to stop us. We think that we're going to do it right. I got this idea and I'm going to do this. What could possibly go wrong? Well, there's probably about 10,000 other people before you who've tried similar things. Maybe not exactly the same. Technology was different or whatever was different. But, you know, the principle is the same. They fell flat on their face or they were, you know, sorely failed very miserably. But you don't know that. And so you don't, you know, you're fearless. I think that's awesome. I really do. I think it's cool. I've been through it. I started a flight school when I was younger. Let me tell you, that was a great idea. At the time, I thought. And, well, it started off with, I just bought this little airplane. I had about $4,000 from the sale of something. I can't remember what I sold. I had bought a kit plane. I can't remember exactly how I did this. I think what I did is I had a credit card. And this was the stupidest thing I ever did. Of course, I never should have gone into debt. I wish I could go back and kick myself when I was 16. I would never have borrowed money for my first car. And there was actually an option for me to not do that. But I did it. Now, it was a good vehicle. And I don't get me wrong. And it got me back and forth to work, which I had to do because I had a loan. I had to work, which took me out of school programs, which probably wasn't a bad thing for me. Not necessarily a bad thing. But it did affect the rest of my life in terms of borrowing, working to pay it off, borrowing, working to pay it off. I was a slave to the rat race of debt. I wish I could go back and change that. It's not a regret necessarily, but it would be an interesting experiment to be able to live that life over again, that part of my life over again, and see what would happen if I never went into debt, even for a house. Where would I be today? Probably living in a cardboard box, but I wouldn't have any debt. Basically, we don't have any. We're getting really close to no debt again, or no debt at this point. We're doing okay. Actually, our balance sheet is way over. We could liquidate everything and be okay. We could be okay. We could afford a really nice box to live in, maybe two. You know, somehow connect them up. Put a little carport between them for a little cozy coop. So we have this issue of, where was I even going with this? I get off on these tangents sometimes. And I, you know, when I was a kid and I had all this, I really don't know what I was going to say. I had all this debt and I piled up. And I started a lot of business. Here we go. See, I knew I'd make it back. we had these businesses. And I tried and I failed and I tried and I failed. And I had the flight school and it was going crazy. I bought a little airplane. Somehow I'm rummaged together to, you know, enough money to buy a kit plane first. Started building that. And I was sitting there. And unfortunately, my house was located in the midst of it was actually in the traffic pattern of an airport. So airplanes were flying over me all day long, and I'm sitting there working on an airplane, trying to build an airplane. It's probably going to take me 2 years to build. And I got frustrated because I'm working on an airplane that doesn't fly, and there's airplanes flying over the top of me, and I got all my money's wrapped up in a stupid airplane that won't fly, and I can't even afford to go rent an airplane to fly, to do what I want to do. I want to build an airplane. I just thought it was a cheap way to do it. So I sold the thing. To a guy out in Oregon. Actually, he lived in Alaska. But he was an airline pilot, and he had a hangar in Oregon. So I put it on the back of my little flatbed Nissan pickup truck, which wasn't originally a flatbed. I put the flatbed on it. But it was because the bed kind of rotted out. So I drove the thing all the way out there on the back of this truck. And with the tail hanging over the front. And I took it all the way out there, and the guy gave me like $8,000 for the thing. So I paid off the, or no, what did he pay me? I can't remember what he paid me. He paid me some money for it. And I came back and paid off some things, and I ended up with about $4,000 left, I think, something like that. And I found an airplane, a little Cessna 150. It was a 1967 Cessna 150 with like 8,000 hours on the airframe and 2,000 hours on the motor, which had a 2,000-hour TBO. Or it might have been 1,800 hours. I think whatever it was right at TBO. In other words, time before overhaul. Recommended. It's not mandatory unless you're flying at 135 or 141, which is, I'll get into that later. Maybe. I probably won't. But just flying it for private use or for instruction, you can use it as long as it's not, as long as it's running and passes an annual inspection and a 100-hour inspection, you can run the thing for, as long as you want. So I bought this thing. I used $4,000 in a credit card and $4,000 in the money I had. And I went over and bought this thing. Flew it home. It had an STC for auto gas, which means I could burn auto gas in the thing, which was a lot cheaper than aviation fuel. And so it was cheap to fly. So I got this thing and I was flying it around. I bought it basically to build time. And also to work on my certified flight instructor license. So that's what I did. I got my certified flight instructor license with the thing. I went out, flew quite a bit. And I ended up flying it down to Tennessee to a little school called Bolivar Flight School. And I was there for like 5 days, went through their accelerated program, stayed in a little cheapy hotel, and then went to the airport every day, flew one of their airplanes. Because it was a 141 school. And I got it done. That cost me, I don't know, a couple grand. Like $2,800, something like that. Or whatever it was. I don't know. Flew a lot. Went through a couple of check rides. Walked out of there with my instructor license. My starter at the time wasn't working in the plane. So I had to hand prop it by myself. Which was real interesting. So I propped it, got it going, started right up, got in the plane, flew home. Some of the funnest flying, in my opinion, in my life. I basically put the chart in my lap. No GPS at that time. I think the GPS was out, but nobody had it. It was a little digital, monochrome screen, if you did have one. I just flew, back, followed the highways and the water towers and cities and all the checkpoints and made it all the way back. Went around a couple storms. Good times. Got back home and I started teaching flying. I had quite a few students. Next thing I know, old Jed's a millionaire. Now, the next thing you know, my dad ended up purchasing a Seneca. And in the process of picking up that Seneca, I knew I needed to go get my multi-engine instructor license because nobody around the area was doing any multi-engine instruction at that time. So I went out to California and I was out there for like 3 days, 3 or 4 days, and I got my commercial multi license, IFR, commercial multi instructor license. I think it was an all-inclusive course. I did the instrument instructor, the multi-engine instructor, all at the same time. Did it all in a Seneca 1 in the school out there. That's why I went out there, was because they had a Seneca 1, and that's what we were looking at purchasing. Came back, we had that Seneca. So now I've got a Seneca doing multi-engine instruction, and I've got a 150. And I realized very quickly that I'm going to need a mechanic because the mechanic at the airport there was too busy. And when something would pop up, I had to have something done right away. And with two airplanes, there was always something popping up as much as I was flying. So hired a part-time mechanic who eventually became a full-time mechanic for me. And I ended up with a couple more airplanes. And I ended up with actually 8 airplanes at one time. And I had a total of a couple of full-time instructors, full-time employees, as well as a bunch of part-time employees. I learned a lot from that experience. I didn't make any money, but I learned a lot from that experience. And that was, another business that if I would have known all the pitfalls in the aviation business, because just about the time you think you're making some money and the cash flow is going and you got some things going on, I even bought an old simulator for doing instruction, for instrument instruction. And I was doing all this stuff, and guess what? The FAA would come out with what's called an AD, Airworthiness Directive. Yeah, you've got a bolt in the motor in that Seneca, all the Senecas that have that particular serial number, from this serial number to that serial number, all those motors, yeah, you got to take those apart and put this new $3 bolt in there. It's an $1,800 fix per motor. Or you've got a Cessna 182, and I was doing banner towing and all kinds of other things too. But you have this Cessna 182 that now all of a sudden has an exhaust issue. You have to have this exhaust modification done. That'll cost you $900 or whatever it is, and you got to ship it off. So now your airplane's down, and you got to ship off the exhaust and get it done. Wait for that to come back. You know, just stuff like that. Just about the time you just think you're going to make enough money to pay your taxes and pay your insurance and pay for withholdings and pay for your fuel bill and your electric bill and your rent. And then something like that smacks you in the face. And it's not like I was spending a lot of money at the time. I know I was living, hand to mouth, basically. My wife fortunately worked a full-time job, and that kind of helped to keep the investment, overturning back into the company to try to grow it. But the larger the company got, the more expenses I had, the more overhead I had, the more I took in, but the more I paid out. If I had to do it over again, I can guarantee you I'll never start another flight school again. But at the time, it seemed like a good idea. And so, but you know, if some young kid wanted to start one now, if he had a good business plan, if he had the right motivation and he had the right ambition to do it, would I get behind it and invest in it? Absolutely. As long as he was willing to take my advice and let me share some foresight for him, some things, some pitfalls to look for. Now, there are a lot of business issues in any business, whether it be manufacturing. I've tried some manufacturing businesses as well, service business, manufacturing business. There are a lot of pitfalls in a lot of different kinds of businesses. And if you know, of course, if you knew how scary they were, you would never do it. But if you have somebody to walk alongside you and say, hey, make sure you get a lawyer to get this done now, because 5 years from now, you're going to be sorry that you didn't do it back then. Make sure you've got a plan for doing this from A, B to C and connecting all these dots. And it's a plan that you can always change. But it's a plan nonetheless. At least you can move forward. Chances are at least you've got a trajectory. It may bounce off several rocks and a couple trees on the process, but at least you've got some forward motion moving. And you kind of have an idea and a vision and a goal. And you have some awareness of things to look for or to watch out for. Because I guarantee you, there's a lot of things out there that look good. When you're starting a business, you might think, well, if I get a partner, I can do a lot more. If I sell out part of the business or some of the control, or if I go under the umbrella of this other company over here, it will free me up financially. Take this responsibility off my shoulders, and I won't have that anymore. And in the process of doing that, you lose a lot of your independence and your control and your ability to make those decisions, good or bad. That, you know, that security comes with a price. And all that said is my point. When we start to accept the security of a sure thing, either from the government or from some other power that be that we're selling our liberty for, we are really selling ourselves into a form of servitude. Some would call it slavery. It's servitude. Because it's still a free will thing. You can still walk away from it. But it certainly is, you know, if you want to continue to move forward with it, you're stuck. Stuck in it. Someone else calling shots and making decisions. So, I guess that concludes my hour. Another story of my life. So now you have some insight into what my early years were like. Why I am the cynical. The cynical comedian now that I am. Yeah. But we still live in a country, and I believe this is absolutely true. We still live in a country where you can pursue your vision and your dreams, and it can be a very fulfilling thing, even if it fails. You can move forward and continue to go and keep moving. And, you know, let it be, you know, I could have spent $80,000 on a college education that would teach me all these things about that someone else did. All these principles, business principles, and all this stuff. And granted, that probably would have, hopefully, that would have kept me from making some mistakes. But you know what? The very costly mistakes that I made, you know, maybe I lost $40,000 or $50,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 along the way. It was an education that you cannot put a price tag on, in my opinion. And the greatest reward or joy of that is that I've actually found a few opportunities to pour in, you know, that what I've learned into some other people's lives. You know, not a lot, but some. And it's awesome. It's an awesome thing to be able to do that. And now there's plenty of other mistakes that they're going to make on their own. I guarantee you. Things that they need to learn on their own. But, you know, at least they have a fighting chance. At least they have somebody on their side and somebody who's willing to give them some insight into some of the bigger pitfalls that are out there and hopefully help steer them away from at least those. Because there's always surprises. There's always other things out there that can happen. And failure is not a lot of fun. Typically, it comes with owing somebody something, be it the government or being a bank or whoever it is. I couldn't find any banks to loan me any money, so I was pretty much on my own. There were some credit card companies. But it could have been really bad if I'd have gone out and taken out this big, huge loan. Which they wouldn't have given me anyway because I didn't have a business plan. So yeah, it's just been quite a wild ride, and we still live in an awesome country. Hopefully, it'll stay that way. But my gut tells me that we are heading very quickly, like this dog trying to dig his hole in a carpet that's glued to cement. It just doesn't work too well, but it keeps trying. So, having said all of that, I guess my hour is up, folks. Yeah. It is Thursday night. I want to try to post this as quickly as possible. I want to thank you for listening, subscribing, sharing your opinions. And, just being there. Because It's another day. It's another chance to make something of our lives. It's been a wild ride. So, once again, God bless. We have a God who's still on the throne, still in control of his kingdom. We're a part of that. So, have a great night, everybody. See you tomorrow morning.